Robin Young, it's here and now. For the first time in his presidency, George W. Bush will deliver his State of the Union address tonight to a democratically controlled Congress. And the speech comes as a new Washington Post ABC poll shows that 65% of respondents say they oppose the war in Iraq. 71% say the country is off track. Well, we'll hear from Americans from across the country in a moment. But first, Rick Klein covers Congress for the Boston Globe. He joins us now. And Rick, in addition to those public opinion polls, top Republican yesterday publicly criticized the president, Senator John Warner. He came out against the president's decision to send additional troops to Iraq. Tough audience overall tonight.
Oh, no question. Of course, the first time the president, this president, is walking into a chamber controlled by the Democrats. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was right behind the president on people's television screens tonight. A lot of people were watching for her reactions. A lot of 2008 contenders would be in the audience, Democrats and Republicans both. But yes, overall, a very skeptical audience among both Democrats and Republicans, both in the chamber and among Americans who are watching at home.
Well, much of the speech has been leaked already. The president is expected to talk about climate change, voluntary mission controls, renew his call for immigration reform. His aides also said he's going to suggest a plan for altering taxes to help the uninsured. And we're reading today about another plan to possibly divert federal funds from hospitals to help states cover the uninsured. Has there been reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats today, actually, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid compared it to a jerry-rigging type of proposal and mocked the idea of taxing people because they get health care that's, quote-unquote, too good. And so there's a lot of skepticism from Democrats. The White House is saying, though, that they're offering that proposal, the health care proposal, the environmental proposals, really as an olive branch of sorts for Democrats to say, look, here's an area that we're willing to work with you guys. We're moving toward your direction. The whole concept of this White House essentially proposing a tax on higher-income earners is really something that would have been considered heresy earlier in the administration. So I think they're looking for some voices in Congress among Democrats and Republicans who are willing to work with the White House really to salvage some pieces of the president's domestic agenda.
Well, freshman Democrat Jim Webb is slated to deliver the Democrats' rebuttal. It's highly anticipated. Remind us why.
There's a couple of reasons why. One is this is the Democrats showcase one of their major players with the rebuttal. This is also aired on national television as kind of an equal time type of thing, although the rebuttal is nowhere near as long as the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Going to Mr. Webb is an interesting choice. The Democrats have pointed out that a year ago he was just a private citizen who was pretty angry at what he was seeing in Washington. He upset one of the biggest giants in Washington in November, Senator George Allen in Virginia.
He won his Senate seat, but he then went on. I just want to jump in to say to upset in some ways the president, because Jim Webb is a former Republican, Vietnam vet, and the father of a Marine in Iraq, and he had that exchange with President Bush at the White House where the president said, "How's your boy?" And what was the response?
He said, "That's between me and my boy, Mr. President," which is a pretty extraordinary thing to say to a president of the United States, for anyone to say.
Yeah.
And it's gotten a lot of attention in Washington and beyond. And I think Senator Webb is seen as a fighter, certainly, someone who's willing to stand up for his beliefs, someone who's also willing to stand up to his party at times and break with Democratic leadership. I think it's a major statement about the importance of the war, about the new position that the Democrats are coalescing on, about what they'd like to see the war go. They're not sending up someone who's known as a dove who says, let's get out of Iraq right now. He's someone who's got a proposal, got a plan. He's got a son who's actually in combat and really with impeccable credentials as a former secretary as well.
Actually, the full exchange, just to get it right, the president asked how the senator's son was, and Senator Webb said, I'd like to get them out of Iraq, Mr. President. Mr. Bush responded, that's not what I asked. How's your boy? And Mr. Webb responded, that's between me and my boy. So many are looking forward to what he might say tonight. Rick Klein covers Congress for the Boston Globe, and I know you'll be watching closely. Rick, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, today we're going to take a step outside the Beltway to sample what Americans are thinking about the State of the Union. There's nothing scientific to our sampling. We just tried to reach out to young and old Americans from various walks of life and regions and opinions. Some we've met before, and we want to start there with Rachel Ashone of Winter Haven, Florida. Her brother, Corporal Ron Payne, was the first Marine killed in combat in Afghanistan. That was in the spring of 2004. She plans to enlist in the Navy next year after she finishes her studies at the University of South Florida. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you.
Because we have spoken before, in 2005, you were one of several family members that had a private and very emotional meeting with President Bush. You said at the time it was an honor that he cried with you, that you felt safe with him. How are you feeling today about President Bush and your expectation of the speech tonight?
I feel that, you know, as a person interacting with him, my feelings as him as a person have not changed. I think that I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say tonight because we're all hopeful for change. I am looking forward to hearing that come through in his speech.
Well, so comfortable still with a person, but maybe not as a policymaker. Do you want the policy to change in Iraq?
I think that we all hope for our men and women to come home quickly, but I think, as Senator Clinton says, that we have to do that correctly. And it sounds to me, from what I hear, that the president is open to those new changes.
Possibly benchmarks, maybe, in order to bring them home over a period of time. What do you think of, well, others who are saying bring them home sooner rather than later because of the violence, the sectarian violence in Iraq?
It's hard to say. You know, I have a cousin that's going to be leaving in March to go back there, and I don't know everything that these people know. I'm confident we'll make the best decision for our military because we're going to be having a whole bunch of different voices now.
Yeah. You know, your brother, and again, our condolences on the loss of your brother. His death, though, reminds us of the increased violence in Afghanistan and the resurgence of the Taliban. Your thoughts on how that war has been waged?
Well, I tell you, I appreciate the recognition because you don't hear much of Afghanistan. We've done really good things there. The year that Ron died, women voted, and the recognition is important, especially for families like us who've lost people there. I think that we also, you know, a big thing that we need to concentrate on is military mental health, and that's something that is a war in itself that we have to fight here.
What do you think of the recent reports, and on NPR primarily, that some of the mental health issues that returning vets had were being discounted by their officers?
I'm actually proud to be one of those people that are being recruited by the United States Navy to go into a field that is increasingly becoming important. And when these guys are, and these men and women are getting out, they're coming into our communities, and we want to make sure that they're equipped with the tools to migrate back into the society.
What are you studying?
I'm studying clinical psychology.
And you hope to apply that through the military?
The United States Navy has a wonderful program, a clinical psychology program that they are taking students in, and will be able to serve Marines and sailors. My dream is to help Marines like my brother and his friends, who are the sole inspiration for this. I've seen it firsthand. They need help, and they need to be able to reach out and not have the stigma attached to it.
Do you think that the government should play a bigger role in that? I mean, do you have criticisms? What can the president do?
I think that's a huge issue for me, not just for military mental health, but national mental health. I think there should be some policies for that. I also think mental health in the military is kind of taboo. It's becoming not so like that. We have a wonderful new commandant of the Marine Corps, James T. Conway, who is, you know, speaking up on things people don't want to hear about. And I think the State of the Union is hopeful. We're in change right now. You know, it looks good for women right now with Senator Clinton stepping up to bat. I just think that the same goes for military health. It's hopeful at this point.
If even the president just mentioning that there are problems, taking some of that taboo away, would that be something you'd want to hear?
Yes, yes. I think, and I think the president meeting with our families gets that. But it would be a good turn for our government, for the military, to say we're going to take care of you guys, and we're not going to just do it with ammunition. We're going to do it with, you know, mental health care providers.
Well, Rachel Ashone, again, of Winter Haven, Florida, studying at the University of South Florida, but planning to enlist in the Navy next year. Her brother was killed in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for weighing in.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
President Bush is also expected to address education tonight. USA Today reports that he'll call for an extension to his No Child Left Behind Act, which is set to expire this year. Josh Otlin is a social studies teacher in Hudson, Massachusetts, about 40 miles west of Boston. He told us earlier that No Child Left Behind relies too much on testing and not enough on the actual performance of teachers in the classroom. And he also told us what's on the minds of his students.
I see a lot of student awareness about sort of global warming or climate change or whatever label you want to put on it. And I'm also seeing in my school a small but growing movement of students that are really outraged at what's taking place in Darfur and want to see some action on it, which is good. It's good to see young people who do have a sense of outrage at what's taking place there.
That's high school teacher Josh Otlin as we continue to take the pulse across the country. Now go to Marshalltown, Iowa, a town of about 30,000 people. They've experienced a huge influx of Mexican workers since the Swift and Company pork processing plant opened 15 years ago. Now, during a crackdown on illegal immigrants last month, immigration agents raided the Swift plant and detained 97 people. Then about 600 other undocumented workers fled town, fearing they'd be arrested next. Martha Garcia is a real estate agent in Marshalltown. She became a U.S. citizen last year. We've visited with her before. Martha, we know you have concerns that the crackdown on illegal immigrants is affecting business. How so?
Swift is a big company, more than 2,000 people working in there. If they take out 600 people, they are almost a little more than a half people working, but it also disappear one of the shifts. The third shift disappear because they don't have enough people. They are afraid to buy in a house because they are not stable in the job.
Have you sold any homes?
No.
Right.
Since beginning of December, I'm not selling any house. I have one in process in the whole 2 months.
Well, President Bush has said he's going to continue to push for his bill that would expand opportunities for guest workers, put immigrants on a fast track to citizenship, bring them out of the shadows, has been his words.
Well, I think he can do more. Instead of illegal people pass our borders, paying $5,000 to people who don't care about the United States, instead of that one, pay to the government $5,000 and give a work permit for 2 or 3 years, it's worth it.
So you're saying that he should push through something that competes with the, what do they call, the coyotes that bring people across the border?
Yes. It is impossible to legalize all the people who come into the United States. But the workforce, we need the workforce.
The workforce.
Because, yes.
What else concerns you, moving away from the immigrant situation? What other issues?
Here in Marshalltown, we have monopolies, electricity company. We only have one. They charge a lot of money. A household with a $50,000 house is paying more in the bill for electrical and gas, natural gas, than for the mortgage.
What is your gas and electric combined?
Oh, my gosh. My bill this month was $369.
What do you want the president to say about energy costs?
Well, looking at other choices and other companies that maybe they can offer more.
Energy alternatives.
Yes.
Martha Garcia, a real estate agent in Marshalltown, Iowa. Martha, thanks so much for your input.
No, thank you so much for contacting me.
Well, just ahead, we're going to continue our scan across the country. We'll hear more on the People's State of the Union from a minority-owned business, a World War II vet. And later in the program, the man expected to lead U.S. ground forces in Iraq defends the president's plan to send more troops there. General Petraeus goes before the Senate, and we'll listen in. Much more coming up here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now, and today we're sampling the People's State of the Union in advance of the president's speech tonight. We go now to Seth Evans, director of sales at Roxbury Technology Corporation. That's an African-American-owned business in a largely minority community in Boston. They manufacture laser, toner, and ink cartridges from recycled materials, and they'd like to stay in the community. Seth, what would you like to hear the president say tonight?
I would like to see the president talk about small businesses and our opportunity to fairly compete on contract opportunities. And that would probably be both in the public and private sector. You know, most small businesses, we're not here looking for handouts. We just want an opportunity to fairly compete on a level playing field. And the access to opportunities that exist are not readily available to small businesses. It seems to me that, you know, lobbyists and favoritism really decide who gets the different contracts in Washington. Access to health care for small businesses is important as well. I'd like to see maybe some tax breaks for small companies to be able to provide that. Now, the federal government obviously isn't as involved in that as the state government is, but I think that, you know, they could make, not necessarily a sweeping law, but they can definitely do something to help access for health care for small companies. Personally, I'm all about education and health care. I think the government should be feeling that same way.
Seth Evans, Director of Sales at Roxbury Technology Corporation here in Boston. Seth, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Well, we turn now to Ben Brown of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He graduated in 2005 from Wesleyan College with a degree in mathematical economics. He's 23, an economist, a mathematician, and he also runs a website with others called Make Me Sustainable. So that's a big clue, Ben. Your passion is the climate and the environment. But as an economist and a mathematician, what do you think is the state of the union?
Well, multiple things. I think that the energy in the environment is definitely a concern, and actually more and truer to home. I think that clearly healthcare is an issue that our nation needs to address. We're one of the only developed countries in the world that doesn't have a nationalized system, and I can tell you, as starting a business right now and struggling to get healthcare for myself, you know, I think that I really think that strangleholds a lot of families.
Do you really, as a 23-year-old, do your friends think about healthcare? I mean,
yeah,
really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that we're the demographic that is most affected by this lapse in the system. Mm. It's because there's a lot of my friends that are waiters, that are bartenders, that are, you know, starting up small businesses, that are writing, that are doing various things, and they are uninsured and they're unprotected.
Huh. What about the economy? The word on the housing market is that, you know, the bubble has burst, so it's more of a buyer's market now.
Well, you know, I think that the question is that whether we trust to buy. I think that a lot of people of my generation and who are thinking about starting families and settling down, although they hate the idea principally of renting, which I hate myself, are scared to, you know, invest in and take that risk of buying a house and not sure where our economy is going to be in 5-10 years. And so I think that there's a lot of anxiety out there. It's very, very apparent.
Well, Ben Brown, again, 23 years old, an economist, a mathematician, and he also runs a website, Make Me Sustainable, so obviously interested in the environment. Aside from any of those issues, what else do you want to hear the president say?
I want to hear the president speak to just general state of the economy as far as distribution of wealth, speak to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina last year, and what that made most apparent is that although our economy over the last 10 years you know, especially the end of the millennia, made a tremendous amount of wealth. The question was how much that redounded to the rest of the population. And I'd like to hear him address how going forward we begin to, you know, have civic ethic, civic virtue as a generation, as a nation. I'd like to hear him, you know, talk about, you know, spending $1 trillion in a war abroad, as opposed to spending a little bit of money at home. Kind of misdirecting concerns abroad when we need to be addressing concerns at home.
Ben Brown, 23, recent graduate of Wesleyan College and CEO now of Make Me Sustainable, the website. Ben, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Robin.
Well, we turn now to Warren Berger in Iowa City, Iowa. He is a retired building contractor and a World War II veteran. And Warren, I understand you're also turning 87 this month, so I'm imagining you've seen many State of the Union speeches. What would you like to hear from President Bush about the State of the Union tonight?
We have a very hostile, divided public, and it seems that the Iraq issue is all-consuming. And I think the president should remind people that his policies since 9/11 have kept all the terrorists out of the United States. So his programs must be having some effect on them, since the terrorists have been in Great Britain and Spain and I don't know where else.
Well, you do know, sir, that a huge percentage of the population, according to the recent polls, do not feel that the war in Iraq is going very well. Do you think the president is being overly criticized?
Yes, I do. I think liberal media is forgetting about 9/11. I think that stopping the terrorists from coming into this country is the main policy that he should pursue. And he's doing that. I just do not understand the criticism at all.
Well, there are people who say that, for instance, sending more troops over just exacerbates the sectarian, potentially civil war already going on in Iraq.
Well, President Bush feels that it may help. And I think since he's done, in my opinion, such a good job, that he should be given a chance for the next 6 months to see if these new policies don't work. Because many of these critics don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's talking about. He has all the inside information that is available. And I think he's doing the best that he can do.
What do you hope for him to say tonight about Iraq?
I hope that he says exactly what I'm saying. He's going to stay the course for 6 months and see if this civil war cannot be taken care of by the Iraqis. And then I hope that the troops come home.
You speak, as we said, as a World War II veteran.
Yes, ma'am, I am. I think the questions that the other people have brought forth are also very important. But there's nothing more important, in my opinion, than this Iraq situation.
Well, Warren Berger, again in Iowa City, Iowa, thank you so much for weighing in with your thoughts on the President's State of the Union.
Okay. I'm glad to do it.
And this reminder, today's polls show that Mr. Berger is expressing an opinion that's in the minority. The Washington Post ABC poll shows that 65% of respondents say they oppose the war in Iraq. 71% say the country is off track. And Mr. Bush's approval rating is in the low 30s, his lowest ever. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Young, It's Here and Now, and the man who's expected to begin leading U.S. forces in Iraq told senators at his confirmation hearing today that the situation in Iraq is dire but not hopeless. Lieutenant General David Petraeus defended the president's plan to send 21,000 more troops to Iraq. Arizona Senator John McCain, who also supports a troop increase, pointedly asked what would happen if Congress votes against the president's plan as opposition to it grows on Capitol Hill.
Suppose we send you over to your new job, General, only we tell you that you can't have any additional troops. Can you get your job done?
No, sir.
Suppose that we send you additional troops and we tell those troops that we support you, but we are convinced that you cannot accomplish your mission and we do not support the mission we are sending you on. What effect does that have on the morale of your troops?
Well, it would not be a beneficial effect, sir.
Joining us on the line now from Washington, Dimitri Sevastopoulos, a Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, could you just comment on that exchange first? The setup seeming to be that if you vote against this or are against the additional troops, you are also against possibly the troops that are there.
Robin, this is a tactic that senators who are opposing these resolutions, which are against the surge, have been using over the last few weeks, which is essentially to say, if you vote for a resolution that expresses opposition to President Bush's plan, then you are sending General Petraeus on a mission with a vote of no confidence, and it's going to be bad for morale of the U.S. troops, and it's going to embolden and encourage the enemy in Iraq.
Now, Senator Joseph Biden, by the way, is saying today, just recently, that there are two groups of lawmakers working on a series of resolutions, and he expects that there will be overwhelming rejection of President Bush's troop increase when those two are combined and voted on by the Foreign Relations Committee, but of course they're not binding. Well, back to today, General Petraeus, a West Point graduate, he holds a doctorate in international relations from Princeton. He commanded troops during the invasion of Iraq, credited with effectively governing the northern city of Mosul. Did you get the feeling that he was respected by his questioners today?
He was. I mean, clearly across the board, every senator showed him a lot of deference, a lot of respect. I think they appreciate that he had a success in Mosul, although when he left Mosul, and he admitted himself today, things went south because they didn't have enough troops after he had gone. But there was a lot of respect for him. They believe that if the U.S. is going to put more troops into Baghdad and into Iraq, that Petraeus is probably the best man to lead the operation. On the other hand, there was a lot of opposition from all the Democrats and several Republicans to the plan itself.
Well, in fact, let's talk about that, because it would seem to our ears, not as educated as yours, that maybe General Petraeus made some news today when he said we'd know if the troop surge was successful. It seemed to be at a later time than others have said. What did he say?
It was very interesting. He suggested that it would be late summer it would be the point when the U.S. would be able to say whether they were having success or not. That's interesting because Robert Gates, the new defense secretary, when he appeared on Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago to defend the new surge policy, he said it would be a matter of months. He said the U.S. would be able to tell whether the Iraqis were fulfilling their commitments to clamp down on sectarian violence before all of the U.S. troops in the surge had even arrived in Baghdad. Now, the Iraqis are going to be out there over the next month or so. The U.S. troops are expected to arrive by the end of May, early June. But General Petraeus seems to be setting the bar a little higher. He's saying that, well, we're going to need at least until the end of the summer. And it seems to me that he's looking for more patience from both Congress and the American people than Robert Gates did.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little more of the hearings. At this point, Senator John McCain pressed the general, Petraeus, to describe how U.S. and Iraqi troops would work together under the same command in nine Baghdad districts. Let's listen.
Do you understand the command and control relationships between the American and Iraqi forces in this new plan? I'm very concerned about unity of command.
We have, in fact, almost a good news, bad news story. The good news is that the Iraqis are willing to take command in many cases. The bad news is that that makes us have to achieve unity of effort rather than unity of command.
We need to get that sorted out, General.
Yes, sir.
I know of no successful military operation where you have dual command.
Dimitri, your thoughts?
Well, I think in any operation, be it military, civil, or any kind of business, when you don't have a clear line of command, a clear line of authority, it makes it very difficult to run any operation, even in the most benign circumstances. In Baghdad, the Americans will have command of their troops. The Iraqis will have command of their own troops. The question is, when you have American troops embedded with Iraqi units, when you have disagreements over whether units should go to certain areas or not, or how they should proceed and tackle insurgents and sectarian violence, who is going to have the ultimate provide the ultimate orders? And I think that's something that's very difficult to do, particularly when you're in a very chaotic environment.
There was another question as well that we thought we should listen in on. Former Army Ranger and now Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, a Democrat, pressed General Petraeus about the manual that Petraeus just wrote for the U.S. military on how to tackle insurgencies. And in part of it lays out a set ratio of troops to civilians. But that ratio would not be met under the president's new surge plan. There wouldn't be enough troops. And Petraeus responded to questioning by saying that private contractors would make up the difference. Let's listen to General Petraeus, followed by Senator Reed.
The U.S. Embassy is guarded by contract guards. My personal security in my last tour was actually contracted out to, I think it was a British security firm, so that we could free up the military police to secure my own officers who did not have security provided for them.
General, that situation has existed before this surge. I mean, I find it hard to believe that you would give as your best advice to this committee that the differential, probably 40,000 troops in terms of doctrine, is going to be made up by ministerial forces of Iraq that are generally unreliable and by private American contractors or other contractors.
Your thoughts, Dimitri?
Well, the manual that General Petraeus wrote suggests that for a population the size of Baghdad, as a rule of thumb, you'd need about 120,000 competent, trained, prepared troops. When the U.S. and the Iraqi forces ramp up in Baghdad to their maximum that's planned at the moment, you'll have 41,000 U.S. and 50,000 Iraqis. And it's true that the contractors have been there already, but one of the interesting things that I think has emerged over the last few weeks, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, sponsored legislation that would make it possible to try contractors under military law, and it's raised a lot of concern with contractors in Baghdad that they may be now in a very precarious situation. So if the military is going to rely heavily on contractors, I think there are going to be some problems.
Well, and speaking of precarious situation, one last question we want to get in here. Now presidential candidate Senator Hillary Clinton asked General Petraeus about the wisdom of putting U.S. troops in direct fire living in Iraqi neighborhoods, which is part of the plan. What did he say?
Well, I mean, he said that one of the ways he defends the plan, and some people said you need more troops in there, is to say it's the way the troops are going to be used which is going to make this surge different from previous surges in Baghdad. And you're going to have more U.S. troops more visibly in Baghdad, in local communities, working out of police stations instead of more fortified at U.S. bases. And this is something that has to be done. And but the danger of doing that is that you're going to probably have higher U.S. casualties.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times, listening in today to today's Senate hearings questioning General Petraeus, the new man in charge in Iraq. Dimitri, thanks so much for relaying that to us.
Thanks, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Well, today's the day. If you're flying to Canada, Mexico, or Bermuda and the Caribbean, pack your passport. Starting today, a birth certificate or driver's license will no longer be enough to get back into the U.S. from those regions. Only about a quarter of Americans currently hold passports, and it's not just Americans who are affected by the new rules. The Canadian consulate is apparently fielding hundreds of calls a day from snowbirds who live in Florida part of the year. And yesterday, there were reportedly long lines at Mexican consulates across the U.S. Well, joining us with more on the new passport rules is Khalil Sakakini. He's editor of GoTravelUpdates.com. Khalil, right now these new rules only affect air travelers. So can you go over them for us and also the exemptions?
Well, the rules are all people entering the United States traveling by air are required to present a valid passport.
And that includes infants, by the way.
That includes infants.
And we understand that the only valid substitutes right now in existence for passports will be identification as a U.S. Coast Guard merchant mariner, a green card carried by legal permanent residents, and active members of the U.S. military are going to be exempt from this. So how do you get a passport if you don't have one?
Offices have been set up in federal buildings, and some of them are even expediting passports so they can be gotten in 24, 48 hours. A family of four typically is looking at an added bill of $400 because it's $97 for an adult but $82 for a child.
And if you want to get it quicker, as you said, it's about $60 for
right.
that. Right. Well, now, the World Travel and Tourism Council says that U.S. tourism to the Caribbean, for instance, counts for about $22 billion, nearly 200,000 jobs. So, first of all, how are the Caribbean countries that now require the passport trying to offset this rule, and how are other, as you said, U.S. territories trying to take advantage of it?
The countries that are affected are engaging in very imaginative promotional campaigns. I see that the Bahamas is offering a free passport. Of course, they reimburse you when you arrive on the islands. Other places are offering free nights, massages, a whole lot of campaigns, because the Caribbean Tourism Association in particular is very, very concerned, as you said, at the loss of jobs and the loss of income, and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands are taking advantage of this and promoting their islands very passionately, which is creating a lot of friction and tension within the Caribbean mm-hmm. community.
We understand that Puerto Rico has run an ad campaign calling itself the hassle-free American beach destination.
Yeah.
And you don't need a passport there.
And that's going to continue for the year, I'm sure.
Well, Canada has a $50 billion tourism industry.
Yeah, also New Hampshire is concerned. They're anticipating a loss of 230,000 Canadian visits to New Hampshire over the next 3 years, which would look at a loss of $20 million in revenues.
Well, you know, we're reading that if you don't have a passport, if you travel to Mexico, Canada, Caribbean, or Bermuda, that you will be stopped and custom agents will decide whether or not, you know, they'll interview you and decide whether or not to let you in the country. So it's not a guarantee you'll be shut out in the cold, but it certainly seems kind of risky.
Yeah, they're not going to send you to Guantanamo, but I mean, obviously, it'll be a long delay. They'll have to vet you, process you, ascertain whether you are who you say you are. And there'll be some grace period for the next week or two, I'm sure, as the word continues to get out. And already passport applications are increasing. So don't delay.
Just get them. And in fact, 94% of Americans flying back into the country last week already had their passports. So it possibly could be that the word has gotten out. But we want to take a look ahead because we understand that somewhere down the road, the other thing that might replace a passport is something called the pass cards
right.
that the U.S. State Department plans to unveil. What are they?
Movement toward a paperless passport. The pass card stands for People Access Security Service, and theoretically, it's designed for citizens re-entering the United States from Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean. It works on a radio frequency identity chip called an RFID. This particular chip contains personal information that then refers the officials to the traveler's database and checks it all out. So it's really designed for frequent cross-border Mm-hmm. crossings in towns.
People who even work across a border.
Exactly. And its success is questionable because a lot of people are concerned it's a profound invasion of privacy, which may be the case. my suspicion is that there may be down the road, everybody has these chips implanted in a small identity card, which can be read from a distance and read remotely.
Well, Khalil Sakakini, editor of GoTravelUpdates.com, as always, catching us up on the new news in travel. In this case, that starting today, if you're flying to Canada, Mexico, Bermuda, or the Caribbean, you must have a passport. Khalil, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. And Young, it's here and now.
The films nominated for Best Picture of 2006 are...
It's the one day almost all of L.A. gets up early. The Academy Award nominations were announced this morning, 5:30 Los Angeles time, in order to make the East Coast morning shows. And maybe the biggest surprise was the film that wasn't on the list for Best Picture, Dreamgirls. The remake of the stage show had picked up a Golden Globe for Best Musical or Comedy, and today it led the Oscar field with 8 nominations overall, including 2 for Best Supporting Actors Eddie Murphy and Jennifer Hudson. But the film and its director Bill Condon... nada. The other Best Picture nominees, The Queen, with star Helen Mirren getting a nod for Best Actress, the indie favorite Little Miss Sunshine, whose star Abigail Breslin won a nod for Best Supporting Actress. Director Martin Scorsese was nominated, as was his film, the bloody Boston gangster movie, The Departed. Clint Eastwood and his World War II film, Letters from Iwo Jima, were also both nominated. And Babel, the story of love, loss, chance meetings, and an inability to communicate, picked up 7 nominations. We spoke with Oscar-nominated director Alejandro González Iñárritu when the film first came out.
I thought that I was doing a film about the differences between human beings, and suddenly I realized that I was doing a film about what brings us together, which is pain. You know, and I think that this film basically is about compassion. This film, too, talks about the borders, not the physical borders, but the real borderlines that are within ourselves. Those kind of borderlines, the only way that we can really cross that is true love. That's the only way.
Some other notes. Ryan Gosling's acting in the small drama Half Nelson took the spot many thought would go to Sacha Baron Cohen, whose blockbuster Borat was pretty much shut out of the top awards. Meryl Streep got her 14th nomination for The Devil Wears Prada. And Al Gore, Press Your Tux, An Inconvenient Truth, the documentary that followed Gore on his national speaking tour on the threat posed by global warming, is up for Best Documentary Oscar. Singer Melissa Etheridge also nominated for her song for the film, I Need to Wake Up.
'Cause I need to move. I need to wake up. I need to change. I need to shake up. I need to speak out. Something's got to break up. I've been asleep. And I need to wake up now.
Well, the internet has opened up avenues of distribution for musicians unimaginable just years ago. DJs collaborate to create musical mashups. You can post a song on MySpace, and the next day it could be the soundtrack for a homemade movie on YouTube. But that expanse of the internet is a nightmare for copyright lawyers engaged in an endless battle to protect their clients' work and stop artists who are looking to make something new out of something old. It's a problem a fledgling group called the Antenna Alliance is trying to solve one band at a time. The group is willing to give musicians free studio time to record. The catch, your music has to be free, too. Here and Now's Kevin Donovan explains.
Antenna Alliance is all about the music, literally. There's no money involved here. The group helps musicians from indie rockers to techno DJs record tunes like this one. Antenna Alliance, or Ant Alliance for short, formed when a handful of college students from Boston grew frustrated that artists were not getting a fair shake from the music industry. The cost of recording made it hard for many musicians to earn a good return on their music, but there was this other problem, too. It's called modern copyright law.
The second you copyright something, it's all right for like 90 years or something like that. So a lot of that information gets locked up, especially when, for example, if you make a song and then you pass away, and then if somebody wants to use that song and, say, make an animation with it, they can't do that.
That's Christina Shi, a co-founder of Ant Alliance. She and her fellow students wanted to encourage a more liberal way of making and sharing music, a response to copyright called copyleft.
The copyleft movement is about empowering the real rights holder, the musician, and not empowering the corporation who forwards the money to record something.
Christopher Budnick is another Antalliance founder. He explains that, under a copyleft philosophy, a musician records music and protects it under a special license developed by a nonprofit group called Creative Commons. You've probably heard the phrase, all rights reserved. That means you need to pay or get permission to do anything with copyrighted music, like duplicate it or put it in a commercial. Creative Commons, on the other hand, grants some rights reserved. Christina Shee explains.
One of the licenses Creative Commons offers is called Share Alike. You can use my work as long as your license also allows other people to use your work. So it's kind of keeping things free.
Antenna Alliance says it embraces what's called the peer-to-peer internet culture. That's internet lingo for the next generation of Napster imitators, where music is virally spread illegally all over the internet. I have a copyrighted Beatles song and I email it to my friend, that's illegal. But if I email an Antenna Alliance-produced song, that's fine because the license allows and even encourages that. The idea is that a band's song then becomes a form of advertising. There are plenty of musicians in the indie scene interested in promoting a liberal music culture, where you earn a living through touring rather than CD sales or royalties. The problem was that few bands have the money to get into a studio to record. The solution for Antenna Alliance was right under their noses.
Hey, this is Miles from Buell, and you're listening to WRBB 104.9 FM in Boston.
So that was a new song by the Arcade Fire off their upcoming album Neon Bible, and it sounds like this album is just going to be fantastic. If you have a request, send it to me, WRBB Radio.
Antenna Alliance found a partner at Boston's Northeastern University College radio station, WRBB. The group got the word out to interested artists. If you're looking to promote a free music culture, come to WRBB. They're giving away free studio time to any interested musician. That is, so long as you record it under a Creative Commons license. But now here comes the tricky part. Let's say you're in a band that's interested in the free studio time, but not so sure it's worth giving up total ownership of your music.
Sign away a blanket right to anything that you created for the purposes of cost. I think that's really short-sighted.
Bill Janovitz is lead guitarist with the indie rock band Buffalo Tom. He says he's seen plenty of nasty contracts in his time. Janovitz says easing the barriers to foster artistic collaboration, that's fine, but a band shouldn't agree to record with the Antenna Alliance just for the free studio time. Also, he sees a risk of abuse.
Once you put it out there for use, somebody else can do something with it that you're going to be associated with, even if you don't want to be. I mean, is some, you know, racist skinhead band going to take a loop of the thing I did? And am I going to be therefore associated with some people that I don't want to be associated with?
Lawrence Lessig, a Stanford University lawyer and the CEO of Creative Commons, says there are protections in the license to safeguard against abuse.
But it is true that the Creative Commons licenses do create a kind of freedom that restricts the artist's ability to exercise the kind of control that Hollywood artists typically like to exercise.
Lessig says more than 150 million works have been licensed by Creative Commons since it started up 4 years ago. For young musicians just starting out, he says giving their music away for free means it may be harder to earn some cash initially, but at least they're being heard.
There are risks, of course, but the most important risk is that you spend a life producing extraordinarily important work, at least to you, and nobody listens to it.
Christopher Budnick of Antenna Alliance is quick to point out that this idea of allowing other people to share their music for free isn't for everyone, but at Antenna Alliance, there's a line forming at the studio door.
Not many people are going to look at the Open Commons idea and say, what are they getting at? What's their play? Because, I mean, the play is we get to make music, and it's a pretty good play.
I love you.
Well, for more on the Antenna Alliance and to listen to more free music, go to our website, here-now.org. That Here Now is Kevin Dovin, by the way, produced that story for us. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
We'll bring a big blanket and spread it out. We'll have some wine and cheese. That's what I'm talking about. Then as the sun starts going down, that's what I'm gonna do too.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.